Fired Up show starts right now.
And welcome, everybody. Welcome to the Fired Up podcast right here on WJMF Media. This is Steve. I host the show each week, and we have a ton of politics to talk about. Not to mention that it is now Women's History Month for the month of March. So we'll be bringing you some segments on that as we proceed through the month. Getting back to what transpired last week, let's start off with Monday and the Supreme Court as they weighed in on one of the two key decisions impacting the campaign season, that being the decision on whether or not to uphold or cast out the decision from the Colorado State Supreme Court that removed Donald Trump from the ballot. Well, the Supreme Court came down with their decision. It was a unanimous decision, although the consenting and dissenting segments were 5-4 within that decision, respectively. All nine justices voted to strike down the Colorado State Supreme Court decision. There was an article about it in Slate that seemed to capture most of the sentiment. This was posted on Monday the 4th, and the headline kind of tells the tale. So again, this was in Slate. The headline, "The Supreme Court's unanimous Trump ballot ruling is actually a 5-4 disaster." It talks about how, as I just said, the Supreme Court unanimously reversed the Colorado decision removing Donald Trump from the ballot because of his engagement in an insurrection on January 6th. But that top line holding is where the unanimity ended because five of the conservative justices just couldn't help themselves. They went much further than the case required, announcing an entirely new rule that Congress alone, through a particular kind of legislation, may enforce constitutional bar on insurrectionists holding office. As the three liberal justices pointed out in a separate opinion that glows white hot with indignation, the majority's overreach, quote, attempts to insulate all alleged insurrectionists from future challenges to their holding federal office, close quote. They are, of course, correct. After this decision, it is impossible to imagine a federal candidate, up to and including the president, ever being disqualified from assuming office because of their participation in an insurrection. Now, just a question here. If I'm not mistaken, the judiciary, one of the three branches of our government, and in particular the Supreme Court, is supposed to be an apolitical body. That is, their goal is not to create laws. That's the role of the legislative branch. It is not to push policy forward. That's the role of the executive branch. What the judicial branch in general, and the Supreme Court in particular, is charged to do is, in the case of the Supreme Court, to be the ultimate arbiter of our laws, to resolve disputes within the law and render verdicts or decisions that set guidance on how the law is to be applied. So passing or adjudicating this decision is one thing, and they were perfectly fine to strike down the Colorado decision. Don't really have a grief with that. I think, you know, Trump being on the ballot isn't really an issue. It's a tempest in a teapot, so to speak. Let the voters decide and let the chips fall where they may. Where I have a problem, and where a lot of the punditry out there is having an issue, is that they went a step beyond and tacked on this new provision that says that Congress alone, not the states, are the ones who can determine under the 14th Amendment, Section 3, if a candidate is disqualified or removed from the ballot due to participation in or support of or aid and comfort to an insurrection. So they took what should be just the decision to decide yay or nay on Colorado and used it to add this guidance or this directive that these decisions going forward can only be made by Congress. Now, think about that for a second. So let's use Colorado. So Colorado has a case that goes all the way up to their state Supreme Court, and they decide to remove candidate Trump from the ballot because they determined, and rightly so, that he participated in or encouraged aid and comfort, so forth, for the January 6th insurrection. Now, that's all well and good. The Supreme Court's well within its right to make that call. What happened is the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, we disagree with that decision, and therefore we are reversing it. That's also within their purview. That's what the Supreme Court does, as I said a few moments ago, and that's fine. Where I have a problem, and you should have a problem, is that they actually use this decision to expand or add new law on how this can be dealt with. So if Congress are the only ones in a federal case of this type, where you have a federal official that is being banned from the ballot because of an insurrection and their participation, etc., that's creating a partisan process based on a court decision. That doesn't fit with what the role of the court is as defined by our founders and as carried out in, you know, regular order practice going forward. So, you know, if we take the Colorado case as an example, let's say, you know, right now we have a divided legislative branch. The Senate's controlled by Democrats, the House is controlled by Republicans. And so if a Republican state is bringing that case, the House may move forward with the process to declare that candidate, remove them from the ballot, but it will fail in the Senate. If we have a case where both houses are in the same party, and, you know, it is the party that brings the action forward, then it's reasonable to expect that the action will pass and that candidate will be removed. If the opposite is true, if it is the opposing party that brings the case and, you know, the majority party ruling the two houses will strike it down. So rather than have it being decided at the state level, which has, admittedly, which has flaws, you know, inherent within it. You need look no further than, you know, the what has transpired in the post Roe v. Wade Dobbs decision scenario of the last couple of years to see how this could play out going forward. What I'm saying is the Supreme Court, in my opinion, stepped outside of its, you know, defined boundaries, not only to, you know, put its political thumb on the scale in the favor of the former president, but also to ensure that unless your party is the party in charge of, you know, both arms of the legislative branch, as well as the state bringing the action, the likelihood that Congress is going to remove a candidate based on your request to do so actually is very slim. In Slate's article, they speak to this point, saying, and again, this is from the article, all nine justices have now agreed that states may not unilaterally disqualify a presidential candidate. Doing so, they reasoned, would allow a handful of states to effectively determine the outcome of a presidential election, undermining the inherently national nature of both the election and the presidency itself. The Constitution's division of authority between the federal and state governments cannot permit a state's go-it-alone effort to disqualify a federal candidate who's running to represent the entire country. And again, I reference you back to the aftermath of the Dobbs slash Roe v. Wade decision to see how that plays out going forward. You have, you know, a bunch of states which enacted legislation or signed into law legislation or activated legislation they had already on the books that went above and beyond what the outcomes of the Roe overturning actually would have meant. So, and you've seen the aftermath of that, that the only correction has seemed to be through the action of the voters. And I am presuming going forward that that's what's going to happen in this case. So the article goes on that says that, however, is where the agreement ends. Five justices, Chief Justice John Roberts, joined by Justices Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, and Brett Kavanaugh, went further. They declared that only Congress may enforce the insurrection clause against federal candidates, as I've already mentioned. And this decision and this addendum to the decision really, you know, opens the door to other applications of the process in other areas of our laws. The article concludes, in their incandescent opinion, the liberal justices walk right up to the line of accusing the majority of doing a special favor for Trump. They are right to do so, and they would have been justified to cross it. The majority had no reason to nullify the insurrection clause other than obvious desire to ensure that no other federal candidates are nixed from the ballot because of their participation in January 6th. An optimist might say that by doing so, the majority was just trying to inject stability into the upcoming election. But close court watchers know that every time this Supreme Court waves the flag of stability, it does so on behalf of Trump and his allies. The Anderson case's bottom line outcome is certainly defensible, but the rest of it serves as an unwarranted gift to Donald Trump and the oath breakers who violently assisted his efforts to overturn a free and fair election. I think that says it pretty correctly. Basically, as I said at the top, the Supreme Court is designed and intended to be a nonpartisan arbiter of the laws of the United States, full stop. This decision, and this is not the first time they've put their thumb on the scale of political procedures. This decision goes way beyond that point, and it's clear that other remedies may need to be sought, just as we see now with efforts going on around the country to codify the protections that were in the Roe v. Wade decision, to codify those into state laws, and ultimately, you know, if you listen to the State of the Union speech by President Biden, which we're going to talk about in a second, to codify it into federal law as well. So we will see what happens with the fallout from this decision. We're already starting to see some indicators of it. Keep it here on Fired Up, and I will keep you updated as things come along. So that was the big news topic for Monday. On Tuesday, of course, was Super Tuesday, and we had Republican voting occurring in the following States, Alabama, Arkansas, California, Colorado, Maine, Massachusetts, Minnesota, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Vermont, and Virginia, with caucuses in Alaska and Utah. And pretty much as expected, Donald Trump ran the table on all of those, with the exception of Vermont, where his opponent Nikki Haley won the primary in Vermont. And pretty much as was also expected, after the dust settled on the elections on Super Tuesday, Nikki Haley suspended her presidential campaign in light of the fact that there is zero chance that she can acquire enough electors or delegates, rather, to take the nomination in the Republican convention, which I believe it's in April. No, maybe later than that. Anyway, Nikki Haley stepped down from the race, leaving former President Trump as the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party. He still has not garnered enough delegates to officially secure the nomination, but that's pretty much all over but the counting. Also, just to be honest to both sides, President Biden swept through all of the Democratic primaries on Super Tuesday with voting percentages in the way high 90% range. So, it's clear that, obviously Biden is going to be one of the last two facing off in the general election. And it is highly likely, unless something totally unforeseen happens within the next 8 months, that Donald Trump will be the other person on the presidential ballot in November. So, of course, the expected post-election analysis consumed pretty much all of the news cycle on Wednesday, and in fact continues to flavor the political discussions going on now, nearly a week later. So that was Tuesday, and Wednesday was analysis day. Thursday, the news that consumed oxygen pretty much everywhere was the president's State of the Union address held before a joint session of Congress. And I watched the entire State of the Union address in real time. And, as most people are saying, President Biden knocked that address pretty much out of the park. It was highly energetic. It was feisty. He was ready for the expected heckling that would come from the Republican side. It really was probably the best speech that Joe Biden has delivered, if not just as president, probably, in his political career. He covered a lot of points in his speech, outlining, his positions on, the war in the Middle East, laying out, his continued pressure for Israel regarding humanitarian assistance and the allowance of aid to get into Gaza, and his support of Israel, no mistake about that. There was an article in The Guardian that kind of summarized what Biden talked about, and I'll hit a few of the high points. Biden, restated his belief in Israel's right to defend itself against Hamas. However, he condemned the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, and more than 30,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli airstrikes and other combat-related actions. As I said, the humanitarian assistance angle was also a subject, and he confirmed and announced that the U.S. military would be stepping up its effort at getting aid to the Palestinians in Gaza, one by increasing the number of deliveries via truck, but also announcing that the U.S. would be building a port, to allow for deliveries of aid to come into the region by sea. So, that was some news from that. Additionally, he very clearly laid out his agenda for the future, as well as talking about the reflecting on the violence in the Capitol on January 6th, and again, making the call that our democracy faces fundamental threats from within, with conservative, the MAGA Republicans attack on that. So, as I said, he was prepared for the expected heckling from the Republican members of Congress. And, some of the highlights were his actual challenge back to Republicans who, heckled at various points in the speech. In the Guardian article, it cites where Republican members of Congress seated in the House chamber as Biden delivered his remarks, occasionally lashed out against the criticism of Trump. Early in his speech, Biden said, quote, "My predecessor failed the most basic presidential duty that he owes to the American people, that being the duty to care. I think that's unforgivable." At that point, as the article cites, one unidentified member of Congress responded to the remark by yelling, "Lies." Biden later directly engaged with Republican members on the issue of immigration, attacking them over blocking the bipartisan border and national security deal that stalled in the Senate last month, as Biden blamed Trump for impeding the bill's passage by instructing members of the House to oppose it. Republicans began yelling at him. In a tense moment, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, a hard white Republican of Georgia, implored Biden to say the name of Laken Riley, a Georgia college student who was murdered by an undocumented immigrant. Additionally, he lashed out and responded to the Republicans, when they again vociferously responded to his call to pass the bipartisan border security deal that Democrats and Republicans had negotiated. And even the Republican author of that plan could be seen and was captured in the video of the event at various points as Biden was describing the elements, increased border security, more funding for border agents, more funding for monitoring technology, and so forth. He could be seen, I think it's Representative Langhorne, could be seen saying and mouthing, "That's true, that's true, that's true." So, it was a feisty, wide-ranging speech, by all accounts, even some segments of the conservative media had to acknowledge that Biden did a very, very good job in delivering his message in the State of the Union speech. Then, as is practice, once the president finishes his State of the Union, the opposing party has an opportunity to give their side in, you know, what is called the response. And for that, they selected Senator Katie Britt, who gave the Republican response. And, you know, this also, you know, from an article in The Guardian, was really kind of a head scratcher. The article's headline reads, "Republicans baffled by Katie Britt's State of the Union response, quote, one of their biggest disasters." And it starts off with, "Katie Britt's Republican response to Joe Biden's State of the Union address drew reactions ranging from the baffled to the satirical to the appalled, even among fellow right-wingers. One unnamed Trump advisor told Rolling Stone, 'What the hell am I watching right now?' Another unnamed strategist told the Daily Beast, quote, 'It's one of our biggest disasters ever.'" You know, it's clear that the senator from Alabama and, you know, her handlers clearly made a tactical error in not only the content of the response, but also the optics of it. Now, you know, Katie Britt is, you know, she was well-spoken and articulate. However, in comparison to the fiery speech that Biden gave, Senator Britt gave a really curious response, in my opinion. Number one, she gave the response from her kitchen in her house. Apparently, the idea was to evoke the homey kitchen table nature of the political scene as the State of the Union, as the elections proceeded. Some of the other responses: Charlie Kirk, founder of the far-right Turning Point USA youth group, said, quote, "I'm sure Katie Britt is a sweet mom and person, but this speech is not what we need. Joe Biden just declared war on the American right, and Katie Britt is talking like she's hosting a cooking show, whispering about how Democrats don't get it." It was bizarre. On one level, it was sort of surreal. On another, it was almost painful to watch. I confess to at one point being tempted to kind of giggle or laugh at it, but, you know, I was just rocked back in my seat by just the overall bad production value of the speech, and I don't know how else to describe it. The optics of doing it in a kitchen were terrible. The delivery, although the content of the message was laudable, the delivery was, you know, worse than, you know, prior responses. You know, think of the Mario Rubio reaching for a bottle of water in the middle of his response, and so forth. It just really showed some bad decision making, in my opinion. One other, you know, comment to bring forward that came out of the Guardian article cites Shannon Watts, a gun control advocate, and she highlighted a darker side to Britt's performance as expressed in a particularly lurid passage. And she cites, "With a wavering voice, the senator described meeting a migrant woman who said she described being sex trafficked by the cartels starting at the age of 12, and who, Britt said, spoke of being repeatedly raped on a mattress in a shoebox of a room." You know, the commenter, Watts, said, "Senator Britt says sexual assault is the worst thing that can happen to a woman while encouraging Americans to vote for a convicted sexual predator." So, you know, it was clearly a night of surprises both good and bad. And, you know, it has been driving a lot of conversation, particularly the Republican response, but, you know, not taking away from the fact that obviously Republicans are trying to rebut the claims that Biden made in his speech, and, you know, decrying and expressing regret over the nature of the Republican response. If I were advising the Republican committee on future State of the Union responses, I would get away. I would advise them to, you know, step away from trying to make optical statements. Let's go back to the response to the State of the Union being, you know, held from, you know, a lectern or a podium, or even from, you know, their office. A more formal setting, a more appropriate setting for a response speech to the President of the United States, regardless of which party is delivering the State of the Union. The opposing party should have a serious, considered, well thought out presentation as well as speech. So, you know, now that brings us up to Thursday. We're going to take our break right here. When we come back, there are some other news stories that occurred last week and some also mentions that I want to bring up. And we'll do that when we come back after the break. You're listening to Fired Up right here on WJMS Media. If you have comments, questions, or would like to express your thoughts on, you know, what we've covered so far, send an email to the show at firedupradio@yahoo.com. I'd love to get your thoughts on it. I'd love to hear what you think about the State of the Union and the Republican response, as well as, you know, all of the subjects we're going to touch in this episode. So we'll be right back after this break.
As veterans, we're no strangers to helping others.
It's what we were taught, trained, and told to do.
It could be for anything, helping a friend move.
Listening to a fellow veteran for hours, at any hour of the day.
Or just simply making time for people, a neighbor, a loved one, or even a stranger.
We're often the first to help others. There's no question about it.
But we do have one question for the veterans listening.
When was the last time you reached out for help?
Perhaps it's time to do for yourself what you would do for others.
If you or someone you know needs resources, whether it's for stress, finances, employment, or mental health, don't wait. Reach out.
Find more information at va.gov/reach. That's va.gov/reach.
Brought to you by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and the Ad Council.
And we're back. Welcome back to Fired Up right here on WJMS Media. So, continuing in the kind of review of the hectic political week that just concluded, amidst all of the hoopla regarding the Supreme Court decision and Super Tuesday, and of course the State of the Union and response on Thursday, there was another little story that popped up on the political whack-a-mole board. I don't know if you saw it, but if you recall, the name George Santos, former GOP representative from New York, who was expelled from the House last year and who still faces a range of federal charges related to his campaign and his finances and so forth. Well, if you were watching the State of the Union, you saw former Representative Santos seated next to Representative Matt Gaetz. We won't read any political meaning into that. Back in the chamber of the House for the State of the Union. Well, Mr. Santos announced Thursday night that he is returning to the arena of politics, and he's challenging Nick LaLota for the House seat in New York's the New York 1 district. So there's an article that came out of CNN that says former GOP rep George Santos, who was expelled from the House last year and is facing federal charges, announced Thursday night that he's running for Congress again, this time to challenge a Republican congressman in New York. Quoting Santos, "Tonight I want to announce that I will be returning to the arena of politics and challenging Nick LaLota for the battle over New York 1. Santos posted this on X, formerly known as Twitter, referring to GOP Representative Nick LaLota. I look forward to debating him on the issues and on his weak record as a Republican. The fight for our majority is imperative for the survival of the country." The article goes on, "The former congressman who had represented New York's 3rd District made his announcement during President Joe Biden's State of the Union address Thursday, during which he was spotted at the U.S. Capitol. Santos enters a battleground contest in New York that's among several races in the state that could decide the House majority. Although he'll face steep odds for his comeback bid, even setting aside his personal baggage in challenging an incumbent in a June primary." LaLota quickly hit back at Santos's new bid Thursday night, citing to raise the standard in Congress and to hold a pathological liar who stole an election accountable. "I led the charge to expel George Santos. If finishing the job requires beating him in a primary, count me in," LaLota said. LaLota had introduced a resolution to expel his fellow New York Republican last fall, saying that he deserves, quote, "to be in prison," end quote. In his announcement for his new campaign, Santos called his former colleague a rhino, or Republican in name only, saying, quote, "New York hasn't had a real conservative represent them since I left office arbitrarily, thanks to rhino empty suits like Nick LaLota." And again, he posted that to X. There's a crowded field of Democrats that he will be running against to take on LaLota. They include John Avlon, a former CNN commentator, and Nancy Goroff, a professor emeritus at Stony Brook University, who lost a bid for the House in 2020. They're among the lead contenders on the Democratic side. Avlon was quoted as saying, quote, "bring it on Thursday night," responding to Santos's announcement. The Santos for Congress campaign also filed organization paperwork with the Federal Election Commission on Thursday night, stating his intention to run for the 1st District. The campaign's new filing also identified the return of a treasurer who previously worked for Santos. You know, now, Santos is the 6th lawmaker ever to be expelled from the chamber. He has separately pleaded not guilty to 23 federal charges, including allegations of fraud related to COVID-19 unemployment benefits, misusing campaign funds, and lying about his personal finances on House disclosure reports. So, you know, I guess there is a magnetic attraction between some Republicans and federal prosecution, just saying. So, you know, if I was a New York resident, or if I was a resident of the New York 1 district, I would be looking at this announcement with kind of a WTF response. This person, Mr. Santos, who, if you remember the case, he allegedly had, several different identities. He represented some very egregious false facts to the voters of New York 3 when he ran for his seat the first time. And, I won't go into the weeds on all of the misstatements and incorrect things that he said. Use your search engine of choice. Google or search George Santos, and you can get the full history of him. But as I was saying, you know, this was one of those head snap what moments, and you know, just again, kind of makes you wonder what the Republican side, particularly in the House, what are you guys thinking? Hey, George Santos wants to run for office. It's all well and good, but for, you know, him to seek the support of the Republican Party and the votes of Republican voters in the district, you know, I've kind of got a side eye glance at that. So, New York One, you know, hopefully, you know, you make a wise choice. There are other options besides Mr. Santos. I think you really ought to look into them. Just saying. So, you know, it's continues to be a very, very interesting political year. And, you know, we're only in March. You know, we are, you know, a quarter of the way now through 2024. And we've just seen some amazing and astounding events and things happen and come across our radar. And this one probably falls into the top five so far for the year. So moving in a different direction or pivoting to a different layer of the political scene, if you're a regular listener, you've heard me say often about how you need to have a wide circle of information sources to help guide your decisions in terms of where you are politically and who you're going to vote for and, you know, which party has your best interests and so forth. One of the sources that is on my radar is the HartmanReport.com, particularly in the person of Tom Hartman. Now, Tom's progressive, and I appreciate his views as a progressive, giving me information and looking at things from a different direction. He posted an article on his website on the 9th titled "How Trump Ends Social Security." Now, Republicans have been talking about revamping, revising, eliminating, restructuring Social Security and Medicare, you know, for years. And, you know, this article, Tom goes into some things that are being brought out in the current political environment. So, you know, his article starts, you know, "Want to end Social Security? Just vote for Donald Trump or pretty much any Republican this fall." And he cites, you know, that every year that Donald Trump was president, he proposed budgets that would have cut Social Security funding and benefits. In 2020, he even campaigned on ending the payroll tax that funds Social Security and Medicare altogether. He cites the Republican Study Committee, which claims 175 of the House's 219 Republican members of Congress released their annual budget proposals last summer, and true to form, they called for the setup of draconian cuts to Social Security. In the article, Tom cites that the title of the RSC budget proposal that deals with cutting Social Security is called, quote, "Preventing Biden's Cuts to Social Security." And he says, if you're baffled by that because Biden has never called for cuts to Social Security, well, you live in the reality-based world. But in right-wing land, Social Security is on the verge of collapse and so needs to be gutted for young people. And key point here, something that, you know, you may get bypassed in the discussion about this that will go forward. According to their document, retirement benefits as they are currently structured cost more than the revenue streams that pay for it. The reforms in the RSC budget would not affect benefits for any senior in or near retirement. And he cites, in other words, the system's going broke and we're going to have to gut it, but not for the older voters the GOP needs. We'll just stick millennials, Gen Z, and Gen X with the pain. He goes on to cite similarly in Project 2025, the nearly 900-page right-wing blueprint for gutting the American middle class, ending voting rights, imposing Christianity on all Americans, killing public schools, and ending women's abortion and birth control rights, also has Social Security in its crosshairs. He argues in his article that the billionaires and bankers who've been lusting for decades over the trillions in cash in the Social Security Trust Fund, how it makes perfect sense that it would also contain explicit threats to Social Security. And then the point that one of the points that stuck out to me, and one of the reasons that the Hartman Report is on my list of sources that I routinely receive feeds from and check on. He cites in the article, they argue that the law doesn't even need to be changed. The big banks could take over Social Security right now if only the right president were to push the issue. Well, Paul, let's think about that for a second. How many recent news articles have we heard about the problems with big banks, whether, you know, whichever bank you're talking about, Chase, Bank of America, or any of them? And they are arguing that you want to hand over the Social Security Trust Fund to these banks who have proven so untrustworthy and so anti-consumer in the past. His article quotes, the most promising avenue for innovation is to involve workers and private sector organizations more directly, freed from unnecessary bureaucratic strictures. Existing statutory language in the Social Security Act does not prohibit non-public organizations from administering the program, nor does it specifically authorize states to do so. And that comes from page 637 of the 2025 Blue Book, Project 2025. He says, after all, if the system were privatized and taken over by the big New York banks, each one could skim off hundreds of billions of dollars every year to share with their senior executives, shareholders, lobbyists, and the Republican politicians and judges they own, just like the Medicare Advantage scam providers are already doing. He cites that he once debated Stephen Moore about Social Security, and Stephen Moore is now leading the Project 2025 efforts to reform the program. He was a former Reagan advisor and neoliberal. He's repeatedly called the program a Ponzi scheme. In the debate he had with Tom, he was adamant that we should, quote, fix, close quote, the system by essentially ending or privatizing it. He quotes Moore as saying, let them, meaning Americans, own the money. It's true that Republicans have been trying to gut or privatize Social Security ever since it was created in 1935. They refer to it, according to Hartman, as alternatively a Ponzi scheme, a con, or as socialism. He quotes and says, these days, Republicans don't even try to hide their hatred for the socialist program. For example, in this election year, each of the Republican candidates for president were unabashed in their commitment to destroy Social Security. Nikki Haley came right out and said that the retirement age of 65 is way too low. Apparently, she never got the memo that Ronald Reagan raised it to 67, and that went into effect in 2022. But 67 is probably also too low for Haley. Vivek Ramaswamy wanted to fire 75% of the employees in the Social Security Administration, bringing the program to its knees and making it impossible for people turning 67 or with disabilities to even apply for benefits. Chris Christie told Americans we need to, quote, deal with, close quote, Social Security by cutting benefits, while Ron DeSantis voted as a congressman three times to raise the retirement age to 70 and to privatize the system. And Senator Rick Scott, who recently met with Trump about the possibility of his bid to replace Mitch McConnell, also called for Social Security and Medicare programs to both sunset at the end of 5 years if Congress doesn't write new legislation to keep them alive. So, you know, the Republicans are hell-bent for leather on in former fashion of eliminating, privatizing, raiding the Social Security system and Medicare, by the way. When you say Social Security, you need to include Medicare in that, which would clearly benefit, you know, more of the top 1%. You know, he cites that the Democratic side is far more helpful for Americans looking for retirement security. President Biden has promised repeatedly to not cut or reduce benefits or go along with GOP schemes to raise the retirement age. He's also called for expanding and strengthening the program, although so far his efforts have been blocked by congressional Republicans. So, you know, it's clear Social Security is a huge area of contention with our elected officials. Senator Bernie Sanders has proposed a new law he calls the Social Security Expansion Act. It would make the program solvent for the next 75 years, answering all the hysteria Republicans are constantly parading in the media by simply asking millionaires and billionaires to pay the exact same FICA tax as bus drivers, teachers, and fast food workers, along with cops, pay. He cites that right now, if someone makes more than $168,600 a year, they stop paying into the system. So somebody making $1,686,000 pays only one-tenth the Social Security tax of somebody making less than $168,600. A person making $10 million a year pays 1/100th of what the average worker pays. And, you know, he cites in it, if the super rich were to pay their fair share, the same percentage as everybody else, it would generate so much revenue that every retired person in America could get a $2,400 a year raise. The key, Sanders says, is to also apply the tax to the forms of income most often received by wealthy people, and that is capital gains and dividends, which are both currently exempt. There's a large group of Democrats, and he cites them in the article, who co-sponsored the bill. And, you know, it remains to be seen if it gains, you know, any traction in the Republican-led House currently, you know, and we can look forward with hope to, you know, Democrats taking back control of the House and, you know, expanding their control of the Senate into a filibuster-proof majority, which would be ideal in the coming election. So that ideas like this can see the light of day, receive debate, and, you know, hopefully make it into a bill to go to the president's desk for signature. So we'll see what happens. We'll keep you posted on, you know, the progress of this this plan and what other plans the Republicans may have for Social Security and Medicare. And finally, you know, we've talked about a lot of subject in this week's episode. You know, we've talked about the Supreme Court decision, Super Tuesday, the State of the Union address, and reactions to it, and all of those things. And one of the things that is a subject of frequent conversation in the media circles around, you know, politics is the voters. Now, we're going to do on this show, I'm going to do a segment on the Electoral College system in a future episode. But I want to talk a little bit about the makeup of the popular vote that happens in this country. So if you remember in the last election, President Biden garnered a little bit more or right around 8 million more votes in the popular vote than Donald Trump did. And in fact, if you go back over the last, three elections or two elections where Trump was on the ticket, he's lost the popular vote in every instance of that. And even in the 2016, where he won the presidency, the only reason he did that was because the votes that he did get were enough to swing the Electoral College in his favor. We could get into a debate over is the Electoral College system still relevant and so on and so forth, and we will do that in a future episode where I'm going to talk about the Electoral College system exclusively. But right now, let's talk a little bit about the popular vote. So there are over 210 million registered voters in the United States. Democrats, Republicans, Independents, Libertarians, and so on and so forth. In the last election, roughly, and this is according to the Pew Research poll, and a couple of pre-caveats to it, understand that not every state requires or even asks registered voters to choose a party. So, the number of active voters is about 123.6 million in among those states that report. And, of that, if you break it down by reported party affiliation, 47.9 million are registered as Democrats. 36.4 million are registered as Republicans. 36.02 million are registered as independent, and 4.02 million are registered to other parties. So by percentage, as I said, Democrats are 47.9 million. That's 39% of the total active registrants that vote. Republicans at 36.4 are 29%. And independents at 36.02 are also 29%, roughly. And the other parties represent about 3%. Now, as I said, these numbers, don't add up to an even 100. And, there's some leeway in the numbers. But you see the picture here, and I've talked about this before on this show, how the popular vote can play out. So, in the last election, as I said, Joe Biden received something like 81 million total votes. Donald Trump received somewhere around 73 million, give or take. So you can see that if you pull from, Democrats and Republicans and independents, you can construct that number in the popular vote for Biden, and you can construct the number that came out for Donald Trump. So, what does that mean going forward? Well, it means that, the objectives of the political parties has to be appealing to more than just their core constituents. They need to be able to reach out and pull in members from, the other parties. And, add into that fact that you often hear about, Donald Trump's base Donald Trump's base represents about 28 to 30% of that Republican vote. So that's 28% or 30%, try and keep the numbers round, of the 29% of the total registrants under the Republican side perhaps identify themselves as ultra-conservative, a.k.a. MAGA. So, you know, 30% of 36 million is, you know, somewhere around 10 million hardcore MAGA voters that represent Donald Trump's base. And, you know, the numbers, you can pluck the numbers and massage them. It's done all the time. I'm just basing on the numbers that came out of the Pew survey and what is kind of known about the size of, you know, the constituent components. So, you know, when, you know, the MAGA Republicans are citing, you know, their control over the Republican Party, keep in mind that, you know, they are not 100% of the Republicans. And in fact, if the primaries that we have already gone through are any indicator, the Trump ticket really only has a committed voter base of about 50 to 60% of those voters. So again, you're talking about 18 million overall voters. Now, if Democrats can, you know, marshal a large percentage of their voter base and coalition that with, you know, moderate or progressive Republicans and independents, you can see where, you know, regardless of kind of what polls are saying, from a pure sense of the numbers, the Democratic side of this country, you know, outweighs the Republican side by what could be considered a substantial margin. Now, having said that, you have to understand when you think about our elections that it's not the popular vote that elects the president. It is the Electoral College. And where those votes fall is, you know, where the energy is being expended. You hear all the time about these so-called swing states or these, you know, these key states, you know, the 7 or 8 states that a candidate has to win in order to win the presidency. And that is, again, based on the makeup of the Electoral College. You know, you could easily, and we will, expend, you know, an episode or more than one episode on, you know, the Electoral College, what it is, how it works, you know, what all of the hoopla about it is, and we will do that in an upcoming episode. But you should understand as to what that represents. You know, the key takeaway is Democrats have roughly 10% more voters in their realm than the Republicans do and the independents do, you know, on their own. So now you can kind of have a sense when, you know, the political system is talking about, you know, how they need to bring in moderate Republicans or how they need to bring in conservative independents and so forth. Now you can see the math that they're looking at broken down by a state level. If you want to see the numbers, as I said, use the search engine of your choice and search for, you know, registered voters, you know, 2020. And I'm pretty sure the Pew Research segment will come up high on that list, and you can check it out for yourself. You can do that diligence on your own, which is one of the key things that we always advocate here on Fired Up. So some things to think about, and, you know, as always, if there are comments or questions, send them to the show at firedupradio@yahoo.com. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I appreciate you for listening. Thank you so much. Please tell a friend, forward the episode. You can find us, search for Fired Up Podcast, WJMS, in your search engine of choice, and we will be in that list. Please, hope you do. Everybody, please stay safe. Don't forget that the COVID and other respiratory viruses are out there. So, you know, take care of yourselves. And I look forward to continuing our conversation again in 7 days.